Hi, welcome to the Tom Hartmann University Book Club. We're reading today from my newest book, Adult ADHD, the first edition, or the first draft or version of which I actually wrote some 20 years ago. But we've updated it and reissued it, and I think you'll find it really interesting. This is from the introduction. There's a substantial subpopulation of the world that has a common and somewhat consistent set of personality characteristics. These traits have, for many people, led to difficulties in school, relationships, and work, and are collectively known among psychologists and psychiatrists as attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD. When researching this subject, I was struck by the number of ADHD adults I met and interviewed who'd chosen to become entrepreneurs, to strike out on their own, to forge their own unique lifestyles and businesses independent of others. Most often, these people are involved in an ever-changing life, often starting many businesses or regularly leading their existing companies in new directions. They thrive on stimulation and living on the edge. One biography of Ben Franklin asserts that he was America and possibly the world's first real entrepreneur, because rather than simply learning a trade and opening a lifelong business, he learned dozens of trades and created more than 30 businesses, as well as social and governmental institutions, the post office, libraries, all kinds of things Ben Franklin created for this country. This creation of something new over and over again is the core of entrepreneurship. Whether you're a company owner or an entrepreneur within a company where your job constantly involves new projects or change. When writing an earlier book, Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception, I heard from a psychologist who specializes in ADHD that perhaps as many as half of all entrepreneurs have ADHD. Now, a few years later, and after conversations with thousands of entrepreneurs around the country, I've come to the conclusion that nearly all entrepreneurs have ADHD to one extent or another. And I would add probably the vast majority of salespeople as well. I'm not speaking here of the fellow who carefully invests his money in a corner dry cleaning shop, runs his own business on that corner for 25 years to finally retire comfortably. While that person may meet some definitions of entrepreneurship, I'd rather refer to him as an independent small business person. Such people constitute an important and stable core of the business life of their community and of this country. Instead, I'm speaking here of those individuals who create or participate in dynamic, thriving, ever-growing, ever-changing companies. I'm speaking of the ones who take chances, who experiment. Henry Ford, who had several bankruptcies before he hit on a formula that worked. Or Thomas Edison, who tried thousands of different variations before he could get a working light bulb. These people's lives are often littered with failures, but their successes have given a spark of vitality and enterprise to America and made our country, particularly in its early days, unique in the world. They continue to bring us innovation and change that give great hope and promise for the future of our nation and the world. Some have applied their entrepreneurial characteristics to become great leaders. John F. Kennedy and Winston Churchill, for example, stand out. Others have created inventions, businesses, social institutions, and art that have changed the world. This book is about people who have overcome their challenges and, in many cases, actually used aspects of their ADHD to achieve prosperity or victory, and for those who would seek to emulate them. This book is for those who are willing to take chances, to forge a new niche in the business, social, cultural, political, or art world, or to create something new, and how to do that successfully. In the writing of this book, I've interviewed many people in the business world, including some of America's greatest. Few would want to jump up and raise their hands and say, yes, I have something that psychiatrists call a disorder. Nonetheless, all were, to my mind, hunters. My term for people with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder is described in this book to one extent or another. They shared stories of their successes and failures from childhood through advanced age that were remarkably similar. From these stories and my own successes and failures as a business person and entrepreneur, I've assembled a collection of specific tools and techniques for people with ADHD to achieve success in the business world. And then, you know, we get into chapter one, the nature of ADHD. We all experience a spectrum of levels of states of consciousness as we go through moment to moment on daily life. On one end of the spectrum is the very open, distractible state that we experience when driving or walking on a busy street, noticing all the events around us, alert to everything in our environment. At the other end of the spectrum are the tightly focused states of consciousness in which we're so intent on the book we're reading or the conversation we're having that the ticking of the clock in the room or the drone of traffic outside ceases to exist. When in a normal and relaxed state of consciousness, most people fall into a place somewhere between these two extremes of open and focused. They shift from open to focused and back with relative ease. It's difficult for the average person, however, to maintain either an extremely focused or an extremely open state of consciousness for hours at a time without such things as meditation, training, or the use of drugs like caffeine. The natural tendency is to snap back to the center line between the two states, which is to have a little bit of both. Some people, however, have an off-center baseline state of consciousness as their norm. Estimates vary between experts and researchers, but these people may represent as few as 10 or as much as 40% of the population. And this is the beginning of that difference that makes for ADHD and how it can be a tool, a useful thing, something that can actually help people succeed in the world. So this is our book report, our book reading today from my book, Adult ADHD, How to Succeed as a Hunter in a Farmer's World.
From studios underwritten in part by Sputnik Radio, this is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Many apologies to those of you listening on Sirius XM or on our commercial radio stations all across the country. You heard our show yesterday. Those of you watching on Free Speech TV and listening on our non-commercial stations, on Pacifica stations and whatnot, probably didn't hear our show yesterday because the internet, apparently not just for us, but for our entire building and maybe the whole block, had gone down. That happens from time to time, particularly here in D.C. But what was particularly upsetting to us is, over the last couple of years, we've had problems with our internet service being kind of flaky. We've had Comcast Business Internet service for years because it was the only thing available in the building that we were in then and the only thing available in the building we're in now. And we were using Vonage for our phone lines, which is an internet-based phone service. And so when our internet service would get flaky, our phone service would get flaky. So we contacted Comcast, who's, like I said, they've wired this building, and said, we want 10 copper telephone lines. In other words, the basic old-fashioned telephone lines that have nothing to do with the internet and won't go down when the web goes down. And they said, okay, that's fine. We can provide that to you. Just sign this little contract. We did. They came out. And the guy brought a box that he was connecting to an internet cable. And we were like, wait a minute, you're connecting a box with 10 phone jacks on it to an internet cable? We asked for non-internet telephone. And he was like, oh, I'll give you 12 copper pair or 10 copper pairs. We already have two other lines for our guests. And it was like, at that point, there was nothing we could do. And so yesterday, not only were we not able to deliver our show to some of our vendors or whatever the word is, I guess, distributors. But also we were unable to take any phone calls because when our internet goes down, everything goes down now because we're entirely dependent on this one company, which is something I've been railing about for years and years. We need competition in the United States. If you lived in France, if this was France, I could have chosen from over 120 different internet companies to provide my service because they mandate competition there. Here, our business model in every industry, this isn't just the internet. This is true of food, it's true of transportation. Look at the airline industry. It's true of the pharmaceutical industry. It's true of the banking industry. It's true of the retail industry. It's true of the fast food industry. It's our model, our business model in the United States is monopoly. It's anti-competitive. And ever since Ronald Reagan in 1981 stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, leading to an explosion of mergers and acquisitions and a decoupling of CEOs and senior executives' concern for the community, the product, the employees, the institution of the company itself, and just left all that behind just to focus entirely on stockholder value, we've got these kinds of messes. So I don't specifically blame Comcast for this. I think that this entire system is, truly screwed up, although I was not pleased that when we tried to call Comcast to get this fixed, we got sales. They answer the phone immediately. You want service, you got to hold. And it took hours before we even knew what was really going on. Anyhow, the headline in the Daily New York Daily News, thanks, Mrs. Obama. Did you watch the RNC last night, the speeches? This was truly bizarre. And frankly, Melania plagiarizing Michelle Obama, I think, is the most inconsequential part of the evening. Although it's the part that has, you know, wall-to-wall coverage and lots of freakout in the media, probably because it doesn't deal with issues. Our media doesn't like to deal with issues, you know, because the Republican Party is going to lose on all the issues if they should discuss them. But in any case, the New York Times put together an interesting juxtaposition of, and this is a relatively short one, it's a little over a minute, or about in a little less than a minute, actually, of Melania Trump's speech and Michelle Obama's 2008 speech at the Democratic National Convention. Here it is.
And Barack and I were raised with so many of the same values, like you work hard for what you want in life.
From a young age, my parents impressed on me the values that you work hard for what you want in life.
That your word is your bond, that you do what you say you're going to do. That you treat people with dignity and respect, even if you don't know them, and even if you don't agree with them.
That your word is your bond, and you do what you say and keep your promise. That you treat people with respect. They taught and showed me values and morals in their daily life.
And Barack and I set out to build lives guided by these values and to pass them on to the next generation.
That is a lesson that I continue to pass along to our son. And we need to pass those lessons on to the many generations to follow.
Because we want our children and all children in this nation to know that the only limit to the height of your achievements is the reach of your dreams and your willingness to work hard for them.
Because we want our children in this nation to know that the only limit to your achievements is the strength of your dreams and your willingness to work for them.
So, you know, first of all, Paul Manafort and the Trump campaign are pushing back like crazy, saying this is not plagiarism. These are common words. These are common phrases. It's just a coincidence. There's no droids in this car. Keep moving along. And they're doing it with a particular vigor that would be absent if, you know, they just had some speechwriter on staff and they could say, okay, it was Ralph. Fire him. Which is leading me to believe that either Trump's current wife, Ivanka, or one of his sons or his daughter, Eric or Donald Jr. or what's her name? Ivanka. Yeah. Is Ivanka is his daughter. Who's his wife? Melania. That's right. Melania played some role in this, but you know, that either his daughter or his sons participated in writing the speech and maybe even came up with these lines. And now there's speculation on the internet that, in fact, it was his probably his daughter who dislikes her mother-in-law, or stepmother, I guess is the right word, and it was sabotage. I don't care. What I care about, and by the way, just to put this one to bed, I tweeted out, okay, so, you know, now we know how this is done. So what's coming up next? You know, when Donald speaks, is he going to talk about, you know, we gather on the sacred ground? I mean, is he going to reprise Gettysburg? Is he going to talk about this day shall live in infamy? Is he going to say we're going to send a man to the moon in 10 years and bring him back alive? You know, but seriously, last night, from the floor of the convention, from the podium, a speaker called for Hillary Clinton to be put in jail. This is not normal. In fact, Hillary sent out an email this morning saying, this is not normal. I'm telling you, this is not normal. And it's Nelson Rockefeller tried to address this back in 1964 And in 5 minutes, when we come back from the next break, I'll share with you just a short clip of that. But frankly, I don't think I've seen anything like this. Maybe a little bit in 64 with the Republican National Convention, you know, the battle between Rockefeller and Goldwater. But this is, I mean, there was so much hate and fear and anger on display last night. It was like one person after another, you know, sobbing about their dead relatives. This was deep, dark stuff.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I mean, this is the Republican Party and part of the American electorate just swirling down the toilet bowl into whoa. And welcome back. Our phone lines are now working, just FYI. We have our internet back. Anyhow, Chris in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Chris, thanks for watching Free Speech on DirecTV. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Good morning from out here in sunny Phoenix. I'm heading to Philadelphia next week to march for all the issues. And I guess my question, if I had to phrase it as a question, would just be, what would you do to help see this last ditch effort, last hope to get Bernie, a man really nobody dislikes, to be our presidential nominee?
Yeah,
to get him up there.
Chris, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen any more than John Kasich is going to end up being the Republican nominee. Both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, you know, got the majority of the delegates. Trump got over the threshold. Hillary Clinton got a little under the threshold, but she's so far ahead of Bernie that I just don't see any practical way that she's not going to be the nominee. I think the more important work, therefore, is to push her to have somebody like Sherrod Brown or Elizabeth Warren as her vice presidential nominee so that we've got a solid progressive on the ticket to fight for, along with all of Bernie's folks, all of Bernie's delegates, to fight for the most progressive Democratic National Committee party platform that we've ever had. And already we're there. And Bernie is like, you know, this is 80% of what we want. Well, let's get 90% or more. And to try to bring people into the Democratic Party rather than alienating them from the Democratic Party, to try to bring people into the Democratic Party to produce social change. And because, I mean, it is entirely possible. The Democratic Party has the largest progressive, has, you know, the House Progressive Caucus, which was co-founded by Bernie Sanders, is the second largest caucus in Congress. It's substantial. There's a lot of good progressives in the Democratic Party. And people say, well, you know, I'm going to go green. I'm going to, you know, go vote for Jill Stein. Bernie Sanders in 11 months created more change in the United States of America, in the minds of Americans, in the Democratic Party. But set the Democratic Party aside. Bernie Sanders in 11 months produced more change in the direction of this country than Jill Stein or the Green Party have in a decade. And it's just, you know, that ain't going to happen either. I mean, you know, Jill Stein's not going to be elected president either. So, you know, I salute the Green Party and I, you know, good on Jill for running. But I think that what we need to do is frankly, what the Kochs and the far right did with the Republican Party is take over a major political party and make it ours. And if we've got a nominee, Hillary Clinton, who actually knows how to use power, I see that as a good thing. If enough of us are there holding her accountable, she knows how to use power. That's a skill that Lyndon Johnson and Franklin Roosevelt had that, frankly, I think President Obama was lacking in his first year or so of office. I think helping her to be the best candidate possible is our work, frankly. Am I making any sense, Chris?
You do, actually. And I really appreciate all that.
Okay. Thanks very much, Chris. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV, and thanks for the call. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Michael Isikoff is on the line with us. He's the chief investigative correspondent with Yahoo News, formerly with Newsweek, yahoo.com/news. His Twitter feed, his Twitter is at Isikoff, Isikoff. And Michael, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you.
So I understand you're at the RNC?
I am indeed.
So...
Quite the scene.
I was going off on a rant in the last block about how as much as the media is all hysterical about Melania's plagiarism, or whoever was the plagiarist who fed it to Melania, and whether it was malicious or not, but I think that the real issue is how dark, how angry, how filled with blood and guts and gore and death last night's RNC speakers were. I'm just curious your thoughts on that. And I understand also that you talked with, you know, one of Trump's military advisors, General Michael Flynn.
Well, I actually thought General Flynn's speech was one of the more amazing convention speeches I'd ever heard. Michael Flynn is the former director of the Defense Intelligence Agency. He was fired from that job in 2014 for reasons that are somewhat in dispute, but he has since emerged as Donald Trump's top national security advisor. I interviewed General Flynn yesterday. He talked about how Trump had reached out to him in February. They've been talking regularly ever since. He's been providing position papers and talking points to Trump himself ever since. And as you know, he was on the short list for vice president and is, you know, widely thought to be, if Trump were to be elected, a future director of national intelligence. Now, I don't know if you watched the speech, but to me, it was rambling, meandering, and had some of the more brow-raising lines I'd ever heard in a convention speech.
It was one of the speeches I missed. Do you have any quick quotes for us?
I was trying to make the point about how we need to get serious about the war against radical Islam and do a lot more than we're doing now. And you know, these are all valid subjects of discussion. But he just ran off on tangents about how President Obama's policy on transgender bathrooms was distracting our troops, and then had this ringing Churchillian line, war is not about bathrooms.
Mm.
Think about that. I'd like you to maybe have your listeners.
Definitely Churchillian,
War is not about bathrooms. War is about winning. Then, of course, he led the crowd in a chant of lock her up, lock her up.
Does he still think that Ayatollah Khomeini is alive?
He actually has written a book with Michael Ledeen, who probably does believe that Khomeini is still alive, because the perspective of the book is that Iran is the focus of evil in the world and is really behind all our problems, even though ISIS, of course, it's the Iranian regime through its Shia militias in Iraq that are actually helping to fight ISIS. So that's a sort of intellectual contradiction that Michael Flynn maybe hasn't worked all the way through. But to me, the most fascinating part of this was in my interview, Michael Flynn has developed a very curious relationship with RT, which is the Russia Today, the propaganda arm of the Kremlin, and quite sophisticated one. Last December, Flynn flew over to Moscow to participate in the 10th anniversary celebration of RT, gave a long interview to one of their anchors, and then attended a gala dinner in which he sat next to Vladimir Putin. That in and of itself was a propaganda coup for the Russian government to have a top former Pentagon official attending one of its events. I asked Flynn a question that he wasn't very happy about being asked, which is, how much was he paid for that event? Was he, in fact, compensated from Moscow for participating in this event? He said, at first he said no. Then when I pressed him, he said, well, you'll have to ask my speaker's bureau, which I took as a confirmation that money from Moscow passed hands into the top foreign policy advisor for Donald Trump, which is no small thing when you put it together with Paul Manafort, who is running the Trump campaign and for years was the top political consultant to Yanukovych, the pro-Putin guy in Ukraine.
Yeah, I was just going to point that out.
Yes, and that Manafort then forged business relationships, as I and others have reported about, with a number of Russian oligarchs who are close to Putin. Yeah. One of them, Firtash, is now currently under indictment by the Justice Department. Another, Deripaska, sure, has been banned from entering the U.S. Because of suspected ties to organized crime. So you have a campaign that has these curious relationships with the Russian government. And then you hear Donald Trump talking, saying some rather flattering things about Putin, talking about taking another look at the NATO alliance.
Hang on just a second, Michael. Shouldn't we be working toward Russia being our ally? I mean, isn't Russia an ally of ours?
Well, I mean, look, that is not everybody believes that Russia is our ally. Certainly, yeah. They haven't been in Syria. We don't coordinate with them. They're backing the Assad government. Our position is Assad should go. They have certainly been backing and providing all sorts of military and financial assistance to Iran. So I'm not quite sure. And certainly here to have in the Republican convention
that's where it seems most discordant.
Has relationships with Moscow that have raised a lot of eyebrows in intelligence circles is a pretty astounding thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, the Republicans are famous for, you know, driving Cold War mentality and let's be afraid. It seems odd, but yeah, interesting. Michael Isikoff, chief investigative correspondent with Yahoo News, yahoo.com/news. Michael, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Good talking to you. We'll be back. It's 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
We'll be back with, Austin Goolsbee is going to be dropping by in a little bit, but we'll be picking up your calls after this. Today we're reading from my book, Rebooting the American Dream. This is chapter one, Bring My Job Home. And we're about halfway into the chapter here. It starts out with the section called The High Cost of Free Trade. During the 1930s, none of the Asian powerhouse economies had adopted American industrialization strategies. So when Franklin Roosevelt put money into workers' pockets and they bought toys or clothes or radios, all those items were made in Alabama or Connecticut or Michigan. Now they're made in China, which experienced a labor shortage in 2009, causing its average wage to increase from 80 cents an hour to $1.14 an hour, and its economy to grow by more than 8%. China has been following the lead of Japan, Taiwan, and South Korea during the past half century, and has become an industrial powerhouse as a result. And ironically, each of these countries got its strategy from us. George Washington's Treasury Secretary, Alexander Hamilton, proposed it in 1791. And by 1793, most of the parts of his report on the subject of manufactures had been instituted as a series of legislative and policy steps. And it didn't start with Hamilton. He was just building on King Henry VII's Tudor Plan of 1485, which turned England from a backwater state with raw wool as its chief export into a major developed state that was producing fine clothing and other textile products from wool. He accomplished this by severely restricting the export of wool from England with high export tariffs, and restricting the import of finished woolen goods with high import tariffs. King Henry learned this from the Dutch. They copied the Romans, and the Romans got it from the Greeks 3,000 years ago. Nonetheless, President Obama continues to follow his predecessors, Bush Jr., Clinton, Bush Sr., and Reagan, all in the religious belief that free trade will save us all. It's all nonsense. Free trade is a guaranteed ticket to the poorhouse for any nation. And the evidence is overwhelming. Even the phrase free trade was introduced by King Henry VII back in the 1400s as something that England should encourage other countries to do while it maintained protectionism. A more contemporary example of the application of that wisdom could be seen in South Korea. In the 1960s, South Korea was an undeveloped nation whose major exports were human hair for wigs and fish, and whose average annual income was around $400 per working family. Today, it's a major industrial power with an average annual per capita income of more than $32,000, and it beats the United States in its rate of college attendance, exports, and lifespan. Korea did this by closing its economy and promoting its export industries. A decade earlier, Japan had done the same thing. 40 years earlier, Germany had done it. In July of 2009, with no evident irony or understanding of how South Korea went about becoming a modern economic powerhouse, President Obama lectured the countries of Africa during his visit to Ghana. As the New York Times reported, quote, Mr. Obama said that when his father came to the United States, his home country of Kenya had an economy about as large as that of South Korea per capita. Today, he noted, Kenya remains impoverished and politically unstable, while South Korea has become an economic powerhouse, end quote. In that day's newspaper, or the next day's newspaper, the lead editorial titled Tangled Trade Talks repeated the essence of the mantra of its confused op-ed writer, Thomas L. Friedman, that so-called free trade is the solution to a nation's economic ills. But South Korea did not ride the free trade train to success. South Korean economist Ha Joon Ching details South Korea's economic ascent in his 2007 book, Bad Samaritans, The Myth of Free Trade and the Secret History of Capitalism. In 1961, South Korea was, as the president said, as poor as Kenya, with an $82 per capita annual income and many obstacles to economic growth. South Korea's main exports were primary commodities, such as tungsten, fish, and human hair for wigs. And that's how the Korean technology giant Samsung started, by exporting fish, fruits, and vegetables. Today, it's the world's largest conglomerate by revenue, $173 billion. By throwing out free trade and embracing protectionism during the 1960s, South Korea managed to do in 50 years what it took the United States 100 and Britain 150 years to do. After a military coup in 61, General Park Chung-hee implemented short-term plans for South Korea's economic development. He instituted the Heavy and Chemical Industrialization Program, and South Korea's first steel mill and modern shipyard went into production. South Korea also began producing its own cars and used import tariffs to discourage imports. Electronics, machinery, and chemical plants soon followed, all sponsored or subsidized and tariff-protected by the government. Between 1972 and 1979, the per capita income grew more than five times. In addition, new protectionist slogans were adopted by South Korean citizens. For example, it was viewed as a civic duty to report anyone caught smoking foreign cigarettes. All the money made from exports went into developing industry. South Korea enacted import bans, high tariffs, and excise taxes on thousands of products. South Korea's transformation was, to quote Chang, as if Haiti had turned into Switzerland. This transformation was accomplished through protecting fledgling industries with high tariffs and subsidies, and only by gradually opening itself to global competition. In addition, the government ran or heavily funded many of the larger industries, at least until they were globally competitive. The government ran or regulated the banks and therefore the credit. It controlled foreign exchange and used its currency reserves to import machinery and industrial products. Now, I'm not suggesting that latter part for the United States, but the fact of the matter is that protecting your economy works. And we're basically the only developed country in the world that doesn't do it any longer. Rebooting the American Dream is the book. Welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you. Okay, so the clip of, you know, I was talking about the xenophobia, the Islamophobia, the misogyny, the homophobia, plagiarism by Melania Trump. Melania Trump was the least of the things that offended me in last night. In fact, it didn't offend me, frankly, at all. It's a self-inflicted wound, or it's a wound inflicted by somebody in the Trump campaign. And since nobody's been fired, I'm guessing it's one of Trump's three kids. But who knows? I mean, this is just my guessing. But the rest of what happened last night was just offensive to me. And frankly, I think it was even so over the top. I was channel flipping back and forth between MSNBC, CNN, and Fox. And Fox didn't actually carry most of the speakers. They had, you know, hosts on talking about things. And well, actually, Fox now has two channels. I discovered a second Fox channel, Fox Headline News. And I watched that for a while thinking it was the Fox channel. And it turned they're next door to each other on our phone or on our cable TV system. But anyhow, it reminded me of 1964. Nelson Rockefeller, Barry Goldwater famously gave the speech, you know, extremism in the pursuit of, in the defense of liberty is no vice, right? And moderation is no virtue. And that followed this. This was Nelson Rockefeller, who was running against Barry Goldwater for the nomination for president of the United States on the Republican ticket in 1964. Nelson Rockefeller representing the Main Street wing of the party, and even arguably the Wall Street wing of the party, and Barry Goldwater representing the hard right, modern day Donald Trump wing of the party, I guess. But here's what Nelson Rockefeller had to say.
These extremists feed on fear, hate, and terror. They encourage disunity.
Now, he was booed. I don't know if you heard that, but he was booed. Because the extremist he was speaking of, it was Barry Goldwater and his buddies. And let me just do one more time. This is Nelson Rockefeller talking about his other Republicans. Now, you're not hearing other Republicans like Nelson Rockefeller in the party anymore, but here he was in 1964.
These extremists feed on fear, hate, and terror. They encourage disunity.
And they encourage disunity. Well, now it's fear, hate, and terror with unity. You know, yes, we all hate gay people. We all hate Muslims. We all hate Democrats. We all think Hillary should be, you know, and on it goes. And it's just, it's reached the point now, I think, where the Republican Party has become essentially a caricature of itself. It's no longer a political party. It's a marketing machine for hate. I don't know how else to describe it. You look at the platform and everything else. It's bizarre. Mike in Seattle. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
Yeah. Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. Let's see. Regarding the plagiarism, I just wanted to broaden the perspective a little. And let's see. There's a new story out here that suggests Melania might have not been honest about her degree in design and architecture from University of Slovenia.
Right. She only attended for a year, but she says she graduated with a degree.
Yeah, and to me, I'd like to sort of tie that story with last night's story. excuse me, if you were applying for a job and the employer was the American public and you had a candidate who lied on the resume, if that's true, about their degree, and then said, well, and here's my material, here's my content, I wrote this speech, this is something I've done, this is my portfolio. Maybe she didn't write it, but if she did, I'll take her at her word. And then she gave a presentation about values taken from the current person whose job you're trying to apply for. I mean, what would you think of that applicant's credibility? And if you look at it all together, and there's been, you know, people say, oh, they're a fraud and stuff. I've never been in that camp, but I lost sleep last night thinking, you know, this might actually get me to be active because I've never really thought of them as being, you know, I've been in the kind of the middle stream camp. But then I was thinking about this. You're standing there and you're giving program flyers to an audience that say, I graduated from this university, and then I'm now taking this material that's not my own, saying it's my own, and delivering it. I mean, yeah. The whole picture is pretty crazy.
Yeah, yeah, it is, and I think it's. I suspect you're not going to see much more of Melania. I have a feeling that she's feeling very burned by this, and she, you know, I've read some reports that she's very ambivalent about her husband's. This is interesting. According to NBC News' Katie Tour, who spoke with campaign sources around the Donald Trump campaign. His ads are about to roll after the accusations the Melania Trump speech Monday might have been plagiarized. Tour filed her report from outside Trump Tower in New York City Monday morning and indicated that the situation is more of a save my marriage scenario rather than just a series of crises on the campaign trail. Katie Tour said somebody's head is going to roll because of this. And I'm just surprised, and somebody needs to stand up and take responsibility for this. And I'm just frankly surprised that it hasn't happened yet. And that's why I'm speculating that it was one of the Trump kids who did this, because otherwise whoever did this would be publicly pilloried, I think. Mike, I got to move along, but thanks for the call. Brian in Westland, Michigan, listening on Sirius XM. Hey, Brian, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. Long-time listener. First time I thought to call your show there, sir.
Thank you.
I was afraid to make this call because it was going to sound like I'm sticking up for him, but you kind of mentioned in Melania's speech how it does. I mean, you hear the cadence. I mean, I heard one radio station play them literally on top of each other, and the cadence is so close, it's almost hard not to say it's plagiarized, but a lot of the topics that's in the speech, I've heard in other speeches, though,
mm-hmm.
you know, bits and pieces of it. It's like, it is kind of formulaic, kind of, you know, when I grew up, you know, I got these kind of,
generic spouse speech. It did not call us to high aspirations. Which frankly, Michelle Obama's speech in 2008 did. It wasn't a terrible speech. And in fact, I think, out of the whole evening, it was the one speech that wasn't filled with fear and loathing.
When she was done,
I turned to Louise and I said, wow, that was, you know, she did a really good job, you know, given who she is and how long, I mean, she's only been a U.S. citizen for 8 years. You know, apparently there are immigrants that Donald Trump likes. And, you know, she could be a real force. And then this plagiarism thing came out, which I think has just kind of neutered her. But, you know, I don't think that that's the big issue. I think it's unfortunate that the media is focusing on that as the big issue. I think the big issue is that last night was all death and destruction. And, you know, tonight will be another variation on the same. And, it's pretty grim stuff. Brian, thanks for the call. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I guess you've answered some of what my question is. I guess here my rhetorical question is, whose convention are we watching here?
Right.
And the reason I formed...
It's Donald Trump's. It's not the Republican Party's anymore.
This is what struck me is that I don't know who said it, but referring to people like George Will and William Kristol, and of course the two senators from Arizona are not present, Lindsey Graham, and these people were referred to as the old establishment elite.
Right.
Are not, as if they'd been deposed.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, so they've all been thrown out. It reminded me of a coup.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, so if they're gone and they're the old established, they disdainfully call them the elite, as they do when they talk about we liberals, we are the liberal elite, then, okay, so also are their ideology and ideas out. Now, what ideas are in? And, of course, you've been highlighting those. They're really not ideas. They're simply... the hatred and negativity. These aren't ideas. And I hate to say it, but it smacks of fascism, and I don't like that kind of hyperbole, Tom. You know that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think it's a you could arguably call it a soft form of fascism, but I think it's actually a very, very hard form of fascism, and this is how it starts.
The thing that concerns me. I mean, there are people in this country that think like this, and it's almost like, you know, when you reduce something on the stove to thicken it up, it's the Republican. Who are these people of the Republican Party? Is this the Tea Party? I mean, when you reduce it down and now it's thickened, it's starting to thicken. It's come to a boil and it's thickened. You've driven off all of the rest of the, you know, you've driven off the rest of the elite. Now, who is this? So they were part of the Republican Party. Is this the Tea Party? Who are these people who have taken over and thrown everybody out? They've deposed the old establishment elite, and now they're planning to depose the rest of the country. That's their plan.
I think this is coming from a group of right-wing cranky billionaires who funded the Tea Party and funded the not just the rise of the Tea Party, but the infiltration of the Republican Party by the Tea Party, and they're succeeding. I mean, you know, one of them ran for vice president back in 1980. And, you know, now they've largely taken over the Republican Party. and they're reshaping it in their image, and there's all this libertarian ideology in the Republican platform now. I think this is what's going on. I think coup is an entirely appropriate word, Paul. I would say it's the coup of the billionaires. And guess who is the nominee? A billionaire. So, it fits perfectly. Paul, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to the program. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with more of your calls, and Austin Goolsbee is going to drop by, too, the economist in the Obama administration. Welcome back. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I just wanted to get back to talking about racism and how we could possibly end it in this country. I think that we have to mandate education of black history, of Indian history, history of Africa, history of Southeast Asia, and get out of the idea of only teaching Western classics, as important as those may be. And I wanted to point out locally, we had the Black Lives Matter people protested by blocking the freeway here, I-94. Well, I-94 was built right through a very prosperous black community called the Rondo, and they just recently, and for the last 30 years, have celebrated, they call it Rondo Days, and that decision was made on the basis of these are poor people, these are black people, these are people that don't matter. And in that neighborhood, they had a very high level of African American entrepreneurial activity that has never reached that level again. And so, these are the kinds of things that people need to know that are white and are privileged, that, our policies, even ones that didn't really, you wouldn't think, well, that's really that bad, they had to build a highway. Well, they didn't build it a few blocks over where all the lumber barons and the, elite railroad barons lived, and they could have done that just as easily. They made up a map. They had the whole map of St. Paul broken up into different neighborhoods, working class whites, they called, they said Negroes. It was, on this map. And so that was sacrificed. And, when people have that kind of history, they internalize that and they think of themselves as not really being part of this community. And it's kind of interesting how history sort of goes full circle. I don't know if Black Lives Matter purposely, did that, but about between the two cities, it's 9 miles, half of that and most of it was, is I-94, was the African American community in St. Paul. And who knows, like for instance, Roy Wilkins, the head of the NAACP for a while, he came from that neighborhood, and Gordon Parks, a very famous photographer, writer. He was a friend of Gloria Vanderbilt. Nobody knows about these kinds of people. And I have to say that despite, all of the, I would say barricades that have been presented to African American people in this community, we still have giants like those two people, and Prince from North Minneapolis, which is another African-American community, where, he stayed in this community, and he invested a lot of his own energy in helping other talent. He was extremely talented, a very, good self-promoter, but also a very talented person.
Yeah.
So, this history is not taught to people, and we miss out.
I agree. In fact, I would submit that one of the books that everybody should read in high school is King Leopold's Ghost, which is not even about America. It's the history of colonialism, particularly Belgium colonialism, but it really puts it in context. John, thank you for the call. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Austin Goolsbee is on the line with us, an economist, Robert P. Gwynn Professor of Economics at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business, formerly chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors. He was the youngest member of Obama's cabinet, and he is currently a strategic partner with 32 advisors and a surrogate for Hillary Clinton, the website hillaryclinton.com. Austin, you can tweet him at Austin, A-U-S-T-A-N underscore Goolsbee, G-O-O-L-S-B-E-E. And Austin, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's a great honor to be back.
It's been, it seems like it's been at least a year. I'm curious your thoughts as an economist to the Republican platform and the Republican rhetoric.
Oh, I think it's, there's not really an economic plan. People are talking about the Trump plan, but in my opinion, it's not a plan. It's a kind of a hodgepodge collection of bad impulsive ideas plus recycled older stuff. And then with the Republican platform, you saw kind of grafted on top of that, really some pretty far right rhetoric and ideas that by even Republican economists' estimation would lead us into a recession. So I guess I don't think very much about it.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on how the Republicans are selling this stuff? I mean, you got Pete Peterson out there, and in fact, his institute is sponsoring one of the events at the RNC, maybe at the DNC, a dialogue about the future of America. He's spent a $500 million over the last couple of decades trying to privatize Social Security.
What I would say is, if you're one of Pete Peterson's people, and I know Pete Peterson, his main thing is the deficit.
Right.
And the thing is, Donald Trump's tax plan would, I'm not even making this up, add over the next 20 years $30 trillion to the deficit. It's by far the biggest high-income tax cut that has ever been proposed by a presidential candidate. So even Pete Peterson, I kind of think the guy's head is going to explode when he actually looks at what Donald Trump wants to do.
Right. So if Trump became president and the Republicans continue to control the House and Senate...
Yeah, we got problems.
Are we looking at the crash of 2017?
Yeah, probably. I think there's a guy... there's a guy who was a McCain economic advisor, Mark Zandi, who's a pretty straight shooter. They gave to him. He went and looked at all the components of the Trump plan and said, if we did this, what would happen? And mind you, this guy's a Republican. He said we would lose 3.5 million jobs and it would send us into an extended recession right away.
Wow.
These aren't Democrats attacking the plan. These are his own Republicans. So I don't think it's a coincidence that the governor, Republican governor of Ohio, refuses to attend the convention. The past two presidents and the past two Republican nominees who did not win the presidency, they're all refusing to come to the convention. Nobody wants to have anything to do with the Trump brand.
I don't think that's because of the economics. I think they're all in lockstep on this kind of Reaganism tax cut fervor, and Trump's tax cut proposal, of course, would really, really benefit him and the billionaire class. I think that they're a little freaked out that he's saying out loud what they've been saying in code for 40 years.
That's probably a good point. As I said, early on when people say, how is this Trump thing catching on among Republicans? And I said, well, it's because Donald Trump is scratching a certain itch that the Republican primary electorate, has. But we can all agree there are some itches you really shouldn't scratch in public.
Yeah.
And Trump is absolutely one of those. And so I think the more – look, it's your mom had the only funny till someone loses an eye. You know, this thing is only funny until you actually think, wait, hold on a second. This guy could become president of the United States. Do we really want to, if you're an independent, if you're a Republican, I mean, are you really going to be for a guy who's taking material from white supremacist websites and retweeting it, who's, you know, accusing the president of being foreign born and not an American
and
you know,
hating
down
police.
The line, just like a bunch of really extremist stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And now he's saying, you know, all you have to do is look at President Obama's body language and you get it, that there's something going on there implying that President Obama hates police officers.
Yeah. And implying, you know, previous to this one with the police officers, which is an outrageous charge.
Yeah.
Back up to the act of terror in Orlando, and he was clearly insinuating that the president was sympathetic to terrorists and that something was going on. He used that same kind of phrasing, something's going on that he's not telling us about.
Right.
It's crazy.
Yeah, this is the you know, it used to be kind of the crazy aunt or uncle, you know, kept in the attic. And now they're running the house.
In fact, they're trying to take over the White House.
Yeah, they're standing out in front of the house with a sign. I mean, we've got about a minute left here, Austin. It seems like the best disinfectant is sunlight here. We just need to be continually exposing.
I think that's true. You know, what I said is, the most damaging thing to Donald Trump and his plans is simply his own words. Just tell people what he actually supports and what he has actually done with his own business in his own business career. And suddenly you see those people who have some interest in him, that you see that interest dry up. They're like, whoa, wait a second. Are you serious? You know, he didn't pay.
I am concerned, though, that, you know, for, you know, I mean, in fact, some of Hillary's ads right now, which are pretty horrible to people like you and me, to many of Trump's base, they may be very appealing.
I'm sure you're right.
I hope she can start running positive ads about what she's going to do. I'm really looking forward to those. But anyhow, Austin Goolsbee, economist, Robert Heath Quinn, professor of economics at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business, formerly the chair of the Council of Economic Advisors. Austin, thanks so much for dropping by.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Always good talking. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.